Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UFM 101.5 radio station. This is a radio program primarily dedicated to highlighting the works of the many talented Canadian jazz artists on the scene today. As you can probably tell by now, my voice is a lot deeper thanks to our lovable friend, COVID. So you're gonna have to get used to it for a while. We'll be joined by Kyle Zavitz, a music educator, researcher, and jazz pianist based in London, Ontario. He received a master's from the UVM Jazz Studies program and also taught there as a sessional instructor. Currently, he's working towards his PhD at the Don Wright Faculty of Music. Before the interview, we'll start off with this really sick Taylor Eichstee track called Sparky off his Grammy-winning album Tree Falls, then to an underrated Bill Evans tune called The Two Lonely People from the 1971 album The Bill Evans Album. Yes, that's the title. Then to the collaborative jazz-slash-hip-hop EP Dinner Party, helmed by Terrence Martin, Robert Clasper, Ninth Wonder, and Kamasi Washington, with Love You Bad.
We'll be joined by Kyle Zavitz, a music educator and jazz pianist based in London, Ontario. He received a master's from the U of M Jazz Studies program and also taught there as a sessional instructor. Currently, he's working towards his PhD at the Don Wright Faculty of Music. How are you doing, Kyle?
I'm doing great. How are you, Garrett?
Pretty good. I guess the first question is, to start off, I saw you have a dissertation entitled Exploring Musical Knowledge in the Canadian Multiple Department School of Music, Ideology, Power Relations, and Identity. So can you talk about what that very long title entails?
Right, and I could have gone longer, so just be glad that I shortened it to that. So very briefly, I was, when I got into start the PhD in music education, I wasn't sure what my topic was going to be. Selecting a topic can be, for some people, they walk in and they know exactly what it is they want to do. For others, they need a little more guidance. And I was certainly up the ladder. I had never really done academia prior to the PhD. And so I started going through my own experiences. And really what I'm looking for is, what's a question, a burning question that I have that I want to explore? And so as I went through, one of the things that kind of struck me was that in all of the schools of music that I was a part of, there were always, because I did jazz and I went through music programs that had jazz departments, there was always a very clear delineation between the classical music, the Western art departments, and the jazz departments, usually. And they're delineated in many different ways. You know, when I was in Austria, they actually had a different faculty in a different part of the city, right? The jazz faculty was a renovated agriculture building, and the classical music faculty was located in like a palace, right, in Graz. So I kind of got thinking about that, and my own experiences in other schools of music as well, where, you know, you had certain wings tended to be a relationship between where you were, the location, and who was there, the jazz musicians or classical musicians. And at times it felt like there wasn't a ton of overlap, or there didn't seem to be a lot of interplay between the two. And there's a lot of reasons why, but I was interested in what those reasons are. So that's really what my dissertation is exploring, and I'm taking it from a sociological lens. So yeah, I hope that's a very brief and very, I could go into more detail, but you don't want me to.
I kind of want you to now, though. You open the door.
I understand that. So I'm using an education sociology lens, and the theorist that I'm using is Basil Bernstein. And so he is very interested in how different forms of communication differently impact identities and consciousness of agents. And so taking this into a music education context, I'm asking how the different knowledges that are being taught to students have an impact on what they see as valuable musical knowledge within the faculty. And kind of where I'm coming from is, faculties of music are a single entity, yet because these different knowledges they are in some ways contested, right? What's considered legitimate for a jazz musician and a classical musician may not always align. And so when we start thinking about how those are different, there's these different musical knowledges that are working to legitimate themselves within the faculty. And how does that have an impact on what people see as valuable? And in a very real sense, how does that impact things like funding opportunities, or even how you title certain classes, program requirements, you know, all of these things. So that's kind of what I'm exploring. And so I did a case study of a Canadian School of Music last semester, and now I'm doing my data analysis. And so I'm wrapping up my fourth year, and I plan to defend in the coming months.
Nice. Yeah, like what you said kind of made like a lot of sense to me as a student, because like as students, we kind of filter out information. We kind of like take what we like. We can't learn everything in university, for so to say. So like we kind of take what we want from like different teachers and learn from different teachers, and then we kind of just meld them all together. So that's a really fascinating like angle to look at it. Yeah. Also, I guess what also gravitated you towards the music research field?
So I fell in love with education kind of early on in my music performance kind of career. That was something I always really loved doing. I always loved teaching piano in a major practical sense. And I've always loved university. That just even the experience, even before I was in music, before I did my Bachelor of Music, I was in a Bachelor of Computer Science in Bioinformatics. I was in this interdisciplinary degree. And I just love, I've always loved the culture of the university as a student. And then when I started getting more involved with it in my master's and as a TA, and then, yes, as you mentioned, as a sessional instructor, I fell more and more in love with and with education, with teaching. So less than research, it was more about extending my education, my education. So I wanted to learn more about that. And so that's why I'm doing my PhD in music education.
Yeah. How did that love of education and the fact that you were also a student at U of M, how did that inform your teaching when you were teaching students? Did you have a process or?
Very interesting question, because it's changed a lot in the last couple of years. Again, I was doing major practical performance for the most part, and performance was my bag. So everything that I was doing, the courses I was taking, how I was interacting with certain teachers, that was all informed by that. And so, as you can probably imagine, when it came to time for me to teach, I was teaching with similar, pedagogical frameworks. And so what I was teaching, my curriculum, and how I was teaching it were largely informed by that. And so I always considered myself to be, growing up, a fairly good student. I always liked things very fast-paced. I liked very fast-paced pedagogy, throw as much as you can at me and we'll see what sticks kind of thing. But that isn't the way that everyone learns. And so I feel like looking back on my own teaching back when I was at Manitoba, even, not that I was, a terrible teacher or anything, but I recognized that there were probably some students who got a lot out of my teaching and some students who would have got less. And so when I started into my music education degree here, that's something that was really challenged for me, is who is benefiting from this style of pedagogy and how can I shift it so that, this works for more students for better ends. And, I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Going off of that, how does your teaching evolve throughout the years? Do you have a predominant philosophy that you used to have back when you were teaching at U of M that you've kind of changed now?
One thing that really stands out to me, one of the big differences for me, was I had gone through higher education with a philosophy that was kind of instilled in me from my professors, that was, if you don't want to be here, don't come. And this isn't specific to the University of Manitoba or to Graz or to where I did my undergrad at Carleton University, but just there seemed to be this thing of, the onus is on you. You're an adult. You got to do it yourself. And so things like participation marks for showing up and taking attendance, right? I never really had attendance. That was never really a thing that, in my undergrad I had to deal with, which wasn't an issue for me because for the most part, I showed up and did my thing. But then when I got to Manitoba, there was this weird shift for me where it was like the teachers, you're now in classes that are 6 students and they know your name and they will email you. If you don't show up, they'll be like, where were you, right? And so that kind of over time, my teaching changed. That's one way that I care very much that students are in class and that they're participating now, much more so than I think that was a value shift for me, because that's not something I necessarily would have thought was important to me as much then. I would have said, that's on you. And now I'm trying to foster that engagement and participation much more so in my own teaching.
Yeah, that student-teacher relationship and
student relationship, which after COVID, it's not that we're after COVID, we're still in the midst of it. But now that we're in person, I noticed a huge shift in my undergrad students and the way that they interact with me and the way that they interact with one another. And I'm teaching the Introduction to Jazz course here at the Western University. And my students, they file in silent at the beginning of classes. And that's so unthinkable to me. The students would be silent, because in all the courses I ever took, the teachers would be like, okay, it's time to stop talking so we can start, right? Shut up. So it's very odd to me. And so I'm trying to get them to talk to one another and communicate and participate. And so that's been something that I've noticed has been a shift.
Yeah.
Build relationships with one another.
Yeah. Talk yeah. to each other.
That was one of the things that I really loved about my undergrad, my master's, where you build connections with people, those networking, like I, I hate networking in a formal sense. That's one of my least favorite things to do. I'm so bad at it. And anyone who knows me well, will they know I'm not good at networking. It brings me a lot of stress, which is something that as a musician, it's a very important skill to have and to be developing and curating. And I've been working on it. But it's interesting to me that I see this, you know, my course is open to non-music majors. So students are they can meet all sorts of people from all over the university campus, right? Poli-sci students, psych students, we have computer programmers, all sorts. So it's like, here's an awesome opportunity to meet people that are outside of the music faculty. So take advantage of that. And I don't know if I didn't push them to do that, if they would.
So. Definitely, yeah, because it's like such a central part of music and jazz too. Mm-hmm. Making connections too.
It's very social, yeah.
Yeah. Since you mentioned that you're teaching intro to jazz, I was wondering, how do you kind of tailor your curriculum for like people who, like the non-music majors per se, or people who aren't familiar with jazz, or people who are really familiar with jazz? Like, how do you kind of structure that?
That's a really, thank you for asking that question. I thought long and hard about how to structure this course. And one of the things that I always felt as a music student, and something that a lot of my professors had said, maybe you've heard this before, this adage, that we don't have enough time for music listening. That's not something that students do enough of. So in some senses, it's a listening course. So one of the key components to this course is it's a listening course. And I have them fill out a journal that goes through their experiences week by week of what they're listening to and how that's, you know, how what they have listened to influences what they're hearing now. And, you know, and they get to curate this long journal at the end of it. They get to look at it and say, like, look at all this stuff I've listened to. You know, they can go back and say, I like that, I didn't like that so much. The other thing that I'm doing is it is in some ways a history and tradition class. Jazz has a developed tradition that if you talk to somebody and ask them, you know, what's the jazz tradition or the history, people will give you the typical eras the same way as they give you with classical music, right? Baroque, you know, classical, romantic, impressionist, modern, you know. We do the same thing with jazz, right? Early, pre-jazz, New Orleans, you know, swing, bebop, and then the classic split of like, oh, cool jazz over here, hard bop, and then somewhere along the line, fusion, if that even is jazz, depending on whoever was, you know, writing the textbook at the time. So this very there's a jazz tradition that's been constructed. And then on the other hand, I'm asking students to critique that and say, not just that tradition, but this can be jazz's, you know, it was embedded in social movement and progression since its outset, right? And it deals with very serious issues of, you know, race from the outset and emancipation, civil rights movement, and other issues such as gender and sexuality, and the boundaries of jazz, you know, what is jazz and what isn't, you know, it deals with all of these issues that I think are very relevant to students, even outside of the jazz context, are relevant to students in their own lives, that they can, through seeing jazz differently, they may be able to, and using a different lens, they may be able to see other things in their lives differently as well. And so I kind of have this triangle in my head of the three points of listening, the jazz tradition and the history, the established tradition, and critiques of those narratives. And I think the critiques inform the listening and how they see the tradition. I think having the tradition informs, you know, their listening as well. So I see it all as very connected. And so those three things are kind of how I situate the class.
Cool. Yeah. Cause I guess that makes a lot of sense, cause like jazz is constantly evolving. And also like from a sociological perspective, there's also the current discussion about jazz and like whether you should call it like Black American music. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on that, because that's been a huge debate, hugely debated topic.
Absolutely. Actually, so I'm really fortunate. I've had a bunch of guest lecturers come in and do and work with my class as well. And one of them was Professor Reginald Lewis, who is currently in Lincoln, I believe, in Chicago or outside of Chicago. And he was gracious enough to come in and do a class with my students on the concepts of race and racism in jazz, which was phenomenal. And he brought up Black American music and what that means and how that has been, you know, the implications of that in the jazz field, because there are people who, for whom the word jazz no longer aligns properly to what they mean when they say jazz, the category, and jazz that symbol, what it points to, don't line up. So it's very interesting. And I'm very wary of delineations in general with jazz. Categories, I'm very wary of categorization. I ask myself why those categories are being implemented for whose benefit, right? This is the, again, like you said, the sociology brain in me. I think it's important that we're able to make distinctions between things. That's a very important skill to have. But I think there's a lot of overlap there too with when people say jazz or Black American music. And Reggie used the term, or Professor Reginald Lewis used the term, or he signed it to Nicholas Payton, I think.
Yeah.
I don't have a clear answer for you. It's a very political answer, that answer. I think, yes, it's great that we have these new delineations. No, I don't think delineations are the be-all and end-all. I don't know. Maybe I said nothing right there.
Maybe you make a great politician in an alternate universe or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Depends on what your definition of is.
Yeah. I guess from my perspective, like the term Black American music, I think like jazz you can technically still call it jazz, but I think if you don't center it in like the Black, like sensibility, like Black American music in terms of like Black people made jazz or like a huge cultural significance to jazz, and like you kind of move away from the feeling of the music or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great point. So there's no question that, you know, jazz originated with Black Americans.
Yeah.
There's like, that's not a discussion at all. One of the discussions that people have had in decades past is to what extent is it entirely a Black American music? And so yeah. I've got on my shelf here, I don't know if this is video recorded as well, the interview, or if it's radio.
No, it's not, just radio.
Oh, okay. Because I've got a lot of books on here that deal with these issues, you know, where people feel like their stakes in the world of jazz were lowered because of this extra focus on a Black-centric view of it. And so like there's a Sid Falter's Lost Chords, which is, I'll give you the subtitle to it. White Musicians and Their Contribution to Jazz, right? So these continue to be issues. Actually, Burke wrote a great chapter in the Routledge Companion to Jazz Studies in 2019, bringing up this issue of the dichotomy of white and Black in jazz, and that it actually also serves to exclude other people as well. And so a lot of my students are very interested in musics of, jazz in Japan, for example, or in China. So these people often get left out of this conversation when you do this Black and white divide thing, or which is a common issue in jazz scholarship in the past. So, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. There's also kind of to talk about like what you're like all the things you've been talking about is really interesting, but I've kind of noticed that there's kind of a stigma against like music research where it's often seen as like too obtuse or kind of mystifying to the average like reader. So how do you find like, how is there a way for like people to kind of bridge that gap to make like music research more accessible?
That is a great question. So with every article you write, every chapter I'm writing, the question is for whom, right? Audience plays a very significant role in what you choose to include and exclude. Again, a very political answer, but it's very true. So one of the issues with music scholarship is a lot of institutions don't hire people. They hire some people to be teachers and some people to be players and some people to be researchers. And I've always felt with the field of music that people have very delineated categories, or at least I've seen that in the past where it's like, well, this person is, their job is to do A and this person's job is to do B, right? So right now I'm writing a dissertation. The language is necessarily academic because I have to defend it with my panel, who are going to be asking very serious questions about very dense sociological concepts, for example. So the audience for that is going to be very academic. There are certain journals in Canada and in the United States and abroad, where the focus, the audience, are practitioners, maybe music educators, high school teachers who are teaching jazz, or music in general. It doesn't have to be, it's not a jazz issue. And so the writing changes, and because the audience changes. So things like the Jazz Education Network in the States has started to release, policy briefs and, resources for teachers. It's in more lay language. What tends to happen is people, the idea of a PhD is you learn everything there is to know about nothing at all. I don't know if you've ever, but the idea that you work so hard to get to this very specific, you're interested in such a specific research topic that it tends to kind of let the rest of the world fall away. And that's a problem for sure in academia, and people who believe that they're moving the field forward in this very specific way. You can't have these huge broad, this dissertation can't be all things to all people, right? So I have to focus and focus and focus and focus. And eventually you have a very narrow focus. So it's an issue for sure in music scholarship, but that's, I think, addressing, having different audiences and knowing who the audience is will help address some of the issues of, it being so mystifying or obtuse, as you put it, that it doesn't tend to reach an audience that for whom it will make meaningful change. For me, I'm very interested in my audience for the dissertation, also not just being my faculty advisors, but also universities. So I would hope that it would have an impact on university policy in the future, perhaps at other schools of music. So I'm not as concerned about the language being dense for that reason in certain sections, as long as, the conclusions make sense to people who aren't necessarily sociologists.
Right. Yeah. It depends on the context.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah. I guess to switch gears for a bit, you studied at Colton University, and you also went for a year of study exchange at the Kunstuniversität Graz in Austria. How did those experiences shape you as a musician and as an educator?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So right off the bat, I have to say, when I switched into Carleton, into the music program at Carleton, because again, I was doing a computer science program initially, I broke my left hand pinky finger within the first 2 weeks of beginning my music studies. So that September, I broke my finger. So instantly it's my first year working, doing a major practical in jazz, break my finger. So my hand is completely out of commission. So right off the bat, I had to shift gears away from a performance perspective. And I instantly went into like theory analysis, composition, arranging, right? And that's kind of shaped my whole career. And I've been working towards that and then having to push against that ever since, because my focus was at that point, while my finger was healing, dealing with those things. So my finger heals, I get a physiotherapist, it starts to heal. By about March of the first year, I fall off a stage holding a harpsichord and break the exact same finger. So it's been broken twice. It never quite healed the second time. This is it, the second time. It will never, you can't see it. The audience can't see it, but Gareth can see it. It took a beating and it still clicks. It doesn't have full mobility. So that's something that I've struggled with in my playing. So after the second time that happened, I basically wrote myself off as a composer, arranger, transcriber. And so I got very good at Sibelius and, working with notation software and writing for other people, because it was much more important to me that I could write at a high level than play at a high level, because I was concerned I would never be able to play at a high level. And that culminated for years. I was writing for others. A good friend of mine who's living in Ottawa, Kofi DePauw, John DePauw, is a classical pianist. Well, he's a pianist. He plays it all. And so I arranged stuff for him when he was at the Schulich School of Music in McGill, doing his master's. I arranged some stuff for him there. And, we kind of had a great relationship there. He also went to Graz. We were the two students who went to Graz together. So in my third year, I went to Graz, third year of music. So my fourth year of studies. And it was wild, right? I'm in a completely different country. I don't speak German. And everyone speaks English there as well for the most part. So very little issue. But I was put in a building for international students. And in Europe, there's a very strong international coalition for international study called Erasmus. I don't know if you're familiar with it, where students who have achieved a high level of study in their first, I think, 2 years can apply to, in third year, travel to another country. And their unit, their country will sponsor them for a certain amount of money. And every country sponsors their students differently. They give a different amount of money. But I was living in a building that was all students from another country. So everyone was from everywhere, right? And what's interesting for me is that I didn't know this, but Erasmus was basically a party year for a lot of these students. They didn't see it as a study year, they saw it as a party year. And so I was living in a building with a bunch of international students who were all interested in partying all the time. So I got to meet a lot of lifelong friends from around the world there. As for my music study, I was studying with Olaf Poltsin, who is a phenomenal pianist from Cologne, Germany, I believe. And he is, like, his hands are magnificent. Like, and so that was something that was very important for him, is trying to develop finger technique. And so I saw that this interview was called the Canadiana Suite. One of the things that he had me do was the Oscar Peterson's Canadiana Suite, nice. Front to back, which was, yeah, phenomenal exercise. And I don't know if I ever got you to do any of those pieces.
I don't think so.
Working together. But they're awesome exercises. Well, they're not exercises. They're full-blown pieces, but they're great for your hands. And so I did those when I was working with him. And a lot of what I did in Graz was based on me developing a really strong sense of rhythm and finger strength as well.
Cool. Yeah. I guess talking about your arranging, like, who would you say are your primary influences when you arrange things, or when you kind of, yeah.
Oh, Herbie. That was easy. I listened at the time. I was listening to a lot of Herbie Hancock, but I also had people who would send me, like, a lot of it was commission based, right?
So
people they're like, hey, can you arrange this for me? Can you transcribe this for me? Can you this? So really, it's a very wide range. A lot of Snarky Puppy, that was something that a lot of people wanted me to arrange for grad recitals or whatever. There were all sorts of reasons that people said, you know, like, why I would want to pay somebody to go through and arrange a thing. A lot of pop stuff as well.
I guess technically you could be you're technically Sibelius tech support, I suppose.
Well, I was, and also the person running it as well. I had a lot of experiences. I had a research assistantship when I was in my undergrad that was a lot of transcription as well. And that's really where I started developing the skills in transcribing.
Nice. Yeah, it'd be like a great experience just going through all that music and.
Exactly. Well, and the same with You're in Town in Chicago as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Speaking of You're in Town, like it's like a satirical kind of legal on like the legal system. So what was it like arranging for that?
Oh, it's phenomenal. So it was arranging, but what it was, I don't know how much I can actually say on the radio, but I had a composer, one of the conductor's scores, and not all the musicians to fit the pit band. And so they were like, we need to turn this however many piece band into something that, you know, we can get six musicians to play. And so it meant, you know, negotiating that and paring it down so that the violin, for example, because we had a violinist, could play the clarinet parts and the, you know, the odd guitar parts or whatever. Yeah. If we don't have a xylophonist, now that's the violin doing that or whatever. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I guess, do you have any like future, like big research projects or any cool things coming up?
Like, I'm working on a dissertation, man. What else do you want from me?
I want you to write a 9,000 page essay on top of your dissertation.
Well, 9,000 page?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Definitely.
It's in the works. I have a book chapter that is currently being edited that's getting published by Bloomsbury.
Nice.
On informal music practice alongside Dr. Ruth Wright here at the university and a PhD candidate, Rhiannon Simpson, an Australian PhD candidate. was also lovely. So they're both lovely. So working with them was a pleasure.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's coming out in the following bit. And I also have I was also working with the Coalition Canada on the upcoming national study for the state of music education in Canada. So working on that report, which should be launching very soon. If it hasn't already launched, I should know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much for being on the show.
No, no problem.
Yeah. Do you, you mentioned listening like in the beginning of the interview. Are there any like cool albums that would be cool to play out with you've been checking out?
Oh, so I've been listening to a lot of Kamasi Washington and Robert Glasper recently. And so with Black Radio 3 dropping very recently as well. But I don't know if you know the album Dinner Party.
Yeah, yeah.
Terrace Martin and Ninth Wonder. So I've been listening to that album. It's been on repeat for me in the past couple weeks.
Thanks to Kyle Zavitz for being here on the show. We'll finish off with two tracks from Kenny Wheeler's 1997 album, All the More, first with the aforementioned track, And Nonetheless. This is Canadiana Suite, signing off.